Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
7 years ago, I was filming at East London Mosque when the story broke. The three schoolgirls from the area had gone missing. They were heading to Syria to join the Islamic State group. Shamima Begum was the only one of the girls to emerge from the ashes of the so-called caliphate. I've retraced her steps to investigate the truth of her story.
What do you think people think of you?
As a danger, as a risk.
The Shamima Begum Story, Series 2 of I'm Not a Monster.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 16th of January, these are our main stories. After a 30-year manhunt, Italy's most wanted mafia boss has finally been arrested in Sicily. Belarus and Russia have begun joint Air Force drills. Is it a sign of a new escalation of the conflict in Ukraine? A new report says extreme wealth and extreme poverty have increased simultaneously for the first time in 25 years. Also in this podcast, reaction after a British police officer admits to multiple rapes and sexual assaults over the course of almost two decades.
It's devastating for the victims. It is devastating to the trust that we are working so hard to earn. Policing has definitely taken a step back.
All that and conservation organisations say they're seeking volunteers to become walrus detectives. We start in Italy, where one of the country's most wanted mafia bosses, Matteo Messina Denaro, has been arrested. He's thought to be the boss of the Sicilian mafia, known as the Cosa Nostra. He was detained by dozens of police as he was having a coffee at a private clinic in the city of Palermo. Italy's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, thanked the police for the arrest, describing their operation as a great victory. Earlier, I spoke to our reporter, Davide Giglione, who's in Rome. He told me more about the public reaction to Mr. Denaro's arrest.
Today, Italy is shocked and surprised because no one was really expecting this. Matteo Messina Denaro has always been a symbol of the almost impossibility of arresting powerful mafia bosses who have been controlling the Italian territory, especially the south, not the whole country, obviously, but obviously very influential and very powerful over the years. And the Italian police managed to arrest him after so many years. It's becoming a symbol of the fact that the state is fighting back, that finally Sicilians and Italians can reclaim that territory, which is controlled by the organised crime for too long. So it's a very, very, very important event for Italy and for Europe, because he was also one of the most wanted criminals in Europe and the world.
And the importance for people in that part of Italy is really to be seen in the video circulated on the Italian media showing people standing in the street and applauding it. But what difference will it make for the Cosa Nostra? Presumably he will just be replaced by somebody else.
So that's what normally happens when a big mafia boss is arrested. But let me just say that Cosa Nostra has been changing over the years. There are different criminal groups in Italy, and they've already been weakened by another criminal group, which is the 'Ndrangheta in Calabria. So the situation is quite complex. But the fact that such an important figure has been arrested, yes, he will be replaced. There will be someone else taking over from him, but it will take time to reorganise for the organised crime, for the mafia in Sicily. And it's really, really important because this means that he's not untouchable. And he appeared weakened with the sunglasses, older, obviously, because no one had seen him over the last 30 years. So this is still really, really, really important.
That was our reporter Davide Giglione. Now, it was this time last year that Russian troops started to mass on Belarus's border with Ukraine. Minsk and Moscow carried out joint military exercises. Then, of course, the invasion came. So what are we going to make now of 2 weeks of joint air force drills between Russia and Belarus? Well, Belarus says the drills are going to be defensive in nature, but in Ukraine, there's fear that it could intensify attacks. I spoke to Olga Ivshina from the BBC Russian service and began by asking what we know about the joint operation.
Not much is known, but I guess that is the purpose of the drills in essence. Moscow and Mr. Putin in particular is really fond of keeping everyone tense. And it seems that for Russian military, which is struggling in Ukraine, it's very important to project this image of mighty military power and also to keep Ukraine tense so that they can't concentrate on one exact direction. At the moment, we see that on the one hand, Russian troops are indeed struggling. On the other hand, they are trying to find ways to launch at least some local offensive operations. That's why it's very important for them to keep Ukrainian forces distracted on as many directions as possible.
And last time that Russian troops invaded from the north, from Belarus into Ukraine, it ended very badly for the Russians after two, three months, didn't it, of them really not getting very far at all. I can't imagine that Moscow will want a repeat of that sort of military failure.
Well, this whole invasion is quite illogical from the point of view of numerous experts, and many experts even before the invasion started said that it is quite illogical. So the fact that it doesn't look likely or it doesn't look as a good scenario doesn't mean it won't happen, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it seems that Russian officials are trying to learn at least something from their previous mistakes, and it's obvious that Mr. Putin is putting some pressure on Mr. Lukashenko. On the other hand, Lukashenko, who is currently ruling Belarus, he has a long experience of sitting on two chairs simultaneously, so to say. So he has been wiggling, he has been maneuvering for quite a while, trying to, on the one hand, project himself as an ally of Mr. Putin, and on the other hand, not to be doing what Mr. Putin wants him.
And Olga, how much of a difference would it make to Russia's military strength if Mr. Lukashenko and the Belarusian forces got involved with them?
It's disputable how mighty Belarusian forces are, but at the moment, Russian army is struggling and it needs as many hands on the deck as possible. And Belarusian forces are quite experienced. I mean, at least they have been trained for a while, unlike Russian recently mobilized soldiers. So anything would be at help to Moscow, but at the moment, it's hard to say whether it's going to happen at all.
That was Olga Ivshina from the BBC Russian service. Well, as we heard, the majority of the fighting is taking place in Ukraine's east at the moment. Kyiv's fighting forces will soon be boosted there and elsewhere by the arrival of British tanks. Later today, the UK government is due to give details of the military aid heading to the country. Our correspondent Andrew Harding has been given rare access to UK military hardware already being used in the battlefield. And he sent this report from the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine.
We are tearing along a snowy forest track, heading towards the front lines here in the northern Donbas. We're tailing a Ukrainian military vehicle, which is leading us towards a secret location for a rare rendezvous with a weapon, a very precious weapon, that's playing an important role right now in this conflict. Just as we're arriving here, I can see that the Ukrainian soldiers are busy taking the camouflage off a British-supplied M270 multiple-barreled rocket launcher. And they're getting ready to move it, to take it off, to fire it. You can hear the thud of artillery in the distance. The rocket launcher's just getting ready now. It's raised its barrel on the back of the vehicle. Any second now. Huge amount of secrecy surrounding this whole project, keeping these rocket launchers hidden from Russian counterattack. Okay, off it went up into the mist above us. Trail of smoke. We're not sure exactly what the target is. We know early this morning the previous two hit an infantry unit and some vehicles and a weapons store near the town of Kremina, which is right on the front line. Okay, and now, running back now with the Ukrainian troops. We need to get out of here quickly before any Russian counter-strike. I'm just walking through what was a Russian base, not far from the front lines. It was recaptured in the last few months by Ukrainian forces. And you can see here, it's like a graveyard of tanks and multiple barrel rocket launchers and trucks and so on. Vast amounts of machinery that have been lost by the Russians, destroyed. And yet the Russians still have so much more in terms of equipment, weapons and manpower than the Ukrainians do, which is why the next few months are going to be so important and why Ukraine is so desperate for more Western support. The commander here doesn't want us to reveal his name, but he's telling me the situation on the front line is very serious. He's talking of a catastrophic lack of equipment, from tanks and transport to more basic supplies. Without Western support like this rocket system, we wouldn't have seized back the land we're standing on now, he says. But it's not enough. If we're going to liberate more territory, we need much more outside help.
That was Andrew Harding reporting. Well, in a vaguely related story, the German defence minister, Christine Lambrecht, has resigned after a series of blunders and PR disasters. Germany is under growing pressure to allow the delivery of German-built battle tanks to Ukraine. Well, Jenny Hill reports from Berlin.
Christine Lambrecht was not a popular minister, mocked for announcing Germany would support Ukraine by sending helmets, criticised for taking her son on a trip in a military helicopter, and blamed for failing to improve Germany's ill-equipped army. An awkward New Year's Eve video message in which she described her positive experiences during the war in Ukraine was the last straw for her remaining supporters. Ms. Lambrecht was due to meet other Western defence ministers on Friday to discuss further support for Ukraine. The German government's under pressure to approve the delivery of German-built battle tanks. It's not yet clear who'll succeed Ms. Lambrecht in a role considered so difficult that many refer to it as the ejector seat.
Jenny Hill. As the world's most powerful political and business leaders gather once again in Davos, Switzerland, to attend the World Economic Forum's annual meeting, a new report has highlighted increasing wealth inequality on a global scale. The richest 1% enjoyed nearly twice as much over the past 2 years as the rest of the world put together. And the British charity Oxfam says that extreme wealth and extreme poverty have increased simultaneously for the first time in 25 years, with total billionaire fortunes increasing by nearly $3 billion a day. Well, the charity is calling for higher taxation of the super rich and a redistribution of the money. Max Lawson is Oxfam's international head of inequality and a contributor to the report.
We as Oxfam, you know, we work with poor people all over the world. Not just in Africa, here in the UK, where people are facing hunger, even in one of the richest countries in the world. And we've got this cost of living crisis. And the juxtaposition between that and this acceleration in wealth to the very top of society, when governments are facing the squeeze too. If you look at governments around the world having to slash spending, make cutbacks to health, to education, we know where the money is. The money is in the bank accounts of the super rich. And we think it's quite reasonable to increase their taxation. For many, many years, they've used increasingly complex schemes to avoid tax, to pretend they have very little income. So you have a situation where Jeff Bezos, you know, familiar to everyone as one of the world's richest men, has a true tax rate of just less than 1%. An average teacher or an average health worker is paying like 30%. That's an upside-down world where the poor are subsidising the rich. So we think it's high time we fix that in the interests of everybody.
Max Lawson. Coming up in this podcast.
You could see her often going to the executive ministries and offices with her constituents. Her passion was her people to stay in Afghanistan.
We hear more about the former Afghan MP who was shot dead at her home in the capital. He's been described as one of Britain's worst serial rapists. And perhaps even more shockingly, until today, David Carrick was an officer with London's Metropolitan Police. Over a period spanning almost two decades, he raped and assaulted 12 women. He has just pleaded guilty to 49 offences, including 24 counts of rape against them. Detective Chief Inspector Ian Moore commended the victims for coming forward.
David Carrick was arrested by Hertfordshire officers in October 2021 following a report of rape. With the subsequent press interest, more victims came forward and, whilst being supported by specialist officers, reported further offences against him. The weight of their evidence was extremely powerful, and today we pay tribute to them. We commend all of the victims for their bravery in coming forward, and would like to thank them for their courage in being prepared to take the stand to see justice served.
Well, Carrick is said to have used his position as an officer to gain the trust of his victims. Barbara Gray is an assistant commissioner at the Metropolitan Police, and she says the effects of Carrick's crimes are far-reaching.
This is devastating. It's devastating for the victims that have had to go through pain and suffering at the hands of a serving police officer. It is devastating to the trust and confidence that we are working so hard to earn from women and girls across London. It's devastating to colleagues of David Carrick, but we know this is a day that policing has definitely taken a step back.
Our correspondent Helena Wilkinson has been at the court in London and has more details.
He started offending around 17 years ago, but the officers from Hertfordshire Constabulary who led this investigation, that is where the majority of PC Carrick's offending took place, they believe that there may be more women out there. There were 12 women in relation to the offences that David Carrick committed, but 13 women did come forward. Hertfordshire Constabulary said that PC Carrick intimidated these women. He put fear into them. He used his position as a police officer to scare them in order that they did not report what he had done to them to the authorities. And as well as the sexual offences, PC Carrick would control and be coercive towards these women. We have been given some examples by Hertfordshire Police who, from accounts that the women have given to them, he would tell some of them when they could sleep, when they could eat. For one woman, he forced her into a cupboard under the stairs in his house on multiple occasions. And DCI Ian Moore, who we just heard from there, said he had seen a dog crate bigger than the space that she was put in. PC Carrick would keep that woman in there. She was intimidated, humiliated, and it was up to him. He decided when she could come out. He would call the women in messages, prostitutes. He would say in messages, "You are my slave." So all the while, over those 17 years, he was putting on his Metropolitan Police uniform. He was carrying out his duties, protecting the public as a serving Metropolitan Police officer. But behind the scenes in his private life, he was raping women. He was violently sexually assaulting women. He was falsely imprisoning women. The details of this case are truly, truly shocking.
Helena Wilkinson there. A national day of mourning is being observed for the victims of Nepal's worst air disaster in three decades. The Yeti airline flight crashed on Sunday just over a kilometre from its destination of Pokhara. Arniko Pandey is a central committee member of one of the newest parties in Nepal and an advisor to the government.
The government has formed a five-member commission to investigate the crash, but there is a large public fear that this will end up as a report on the shelf somewhere, as happened after previous crashes. And our strong stance in our party and the minister himself is that that's not enough. We have to make sure that such crashes don't happen again. And so what is needed is a better audit of where do things go wrong in Nepal. Of course, we have very difficult terrain. We have very difficult weather. But are there issues with the safety culture? Are there issues with aircraft maintenance? Are there issues with decision-making when flying in marginal conditions?
The BBC's Rajini Vajanathan is at the crash scene in the gorge of the Seti River.
Hundreds of locals have gathered and they're looking out at the crash site, and the smell of smoke is hanging thick in the air, and I can see parts of the wreckage. One side of the aircraft is sort of lying on its side. You can still see the windows not too far away. You can see some of the blue airline seats that are all mangled now. Rescuers here have given up all hope of finding any survivors. Now they're focusing on finding any clues to work out how this tragedy happened. We know now that they have found the black box flight recorder, and officials told us that they're expecting to bring that up at some point later in the day.
And Rajini, certainly a lot has been made about the poor record of safety, particularly for internal flights. I imagine people will want answers and want this investigation to be more thorough, perhaps, than previous ones?
People do want answers. The country's prime minister has ordered an official investigation. He wants that to report back in 45 days. Now, one of the things that is talked about is the difficult terrain, the mountainous terrain and the weather that can change at the last minute, that can be very tricky for pilots to navigate. They did have a conversation with the spokesperson for Pokhara International Airport. And he told me that the conditions in the air yesterday were very good. The skies were good, the winds weren't abnormal. He did say that just before the plane was about to land, the pilot requested to change the runway that the plane was going to land on. He doesn't know why, but they made the request. They switched the runway that the plane was going to land on because there was no other planes in the airspace. Shortly afterwards, the plane then crashed. There are so many questions, and today Nepal is a nation in mourning.
Rajini Vaidyanathan at the crash site in Nepal. Now, as you might have heard in our previous podcast, Afghan police have confirmed that a former Afghan MP and her bodyguard have been shot dead at her home in the capital, Kabul. Mosal Nabizadeh was one of 9 out of 69 female MPs who chose to stay in the country after the Taliban returned to power in August 2021. Former colleagues praised Ms. Nabizadeh as a fearless champion for Afghanistan who turned down a chance to leave the country. Since the Taliban returned to power 2 years ago, women have been removed from nearly all areas of public life. Fawzia Koofi, Afghanistan's first woman deputy speaker of parliament, has been speaking to Krupa Paddy and first gave her reaction to the news.
It's heartbreaking to see one of our young colleagues who, when she was elected, called me and asked me for my advice on her political career and how should she position herself, was killed brutally. She initially chose to stay when she could fly, but over time, recently, when there were more risks towards her, she called several times for possibility of leaving. But of course, it was not possible for me because simply many countries now don't listen anymore to the voices of Afghan women who are in Afghanistan. So It's sad.
Can you give us a sense of what she was like as a person?
A young, ambitious woman who wanted to offer so much to her country, like many other women and girls in Afghanistan. She wanted to be part of the progress of her society. At her young age, she ran for parliament and then was elected from Kabul, where now she is killed. You could see her often going to the executive ministries and offices with her constituents. She was attached to her people, and that was, you know, the reason. Her passion was her people, to stay in Afghanistan.
She also worked for an NGO, I understand. And we know that in recent weeks, recent months, women have been curbed in their activity when it comes to working with NGOs. In fact, told that they no longer can work for NGOs. Do you think that has to any extent made her more vulnerable?
Especially after the recent ban of Taliban on the 26th of December, asking women to stay home and not work even with NGOs and the UN, that she wanted to really leave, and she contacted me. And after she was killed, another female member of parliament from, you know, south part of Afghanistan contacted me yesterday with a very terrifying message saying that now next might be me. Can you help me get out? All of these messages are the stressful part of my life being in exile, because we can't do much about our sisters who are in Pakistan or in Iran waiting to go a safer place, and those who are in Afghanistan constantly, not that they are only facing security threat, but no hope and opportunity.
What is the situation now? How many female MPs remain in the country? Are they all, like you say, trying to seek an exit from the country now?
Yes, almost every one of them contacted me since yesterday. I have their voice messages and their text messages asking for possible support to leave the country.
That is quite something that since yesterday, since the announcement that Mosal Nabizadeh has been shot, has been killed, you've had almost all of the women who remain in Afghanistan calling you for help. This is how desperate the situation has become for them.
The number of calls have increased, but obviously the message that I got from one of her colleagues, Mosal Nabizadeh's like close colleague yesterday, she said the next might be me. And she is one of those who actually lost a family member, close family member, in the army fighting with Taliban. Yes. And she stayed in Afghanistan because she wanted to take care of the children of the family member that she lost.
Fawzia Koofi, Afghanistan's first woman deputy speaker of parliament. The Italian actress Gina Lollobrigida, one of Europe's most prominent film stars of the 1950s and early 1960s, has died. She played the female lead in numerous Hollywood films. Mark Duff looks back at her life.
Despite a career that spanned half a century, she liked to claim she became an actor, almost by mistake.
I was a student in art school, painting. And they stopped me on the street and they asked me to do the movie. So I didn't want to be a star, but in spite of that, I finished to be a star.
John Huston's Beat the Devil cast Gina Lollobrigida opposite Humphrey Bogart, who said she made Marilyn Monroe look like a child actress.
Ever since I met you, you feel my thinking. You are becoming an obsession.
Mark Duff with that report. The funeral of the last king of Greece, Constantine II, has taken place in the Greek capital, Athens. The former king was a rather divisive figure in the country, ruling for only 3 years before a military coup seized control in 1967. Greece later rejected the monarchy in 1974, and he spent the most of the rest of his life living in exile. Our Europe regional editor is Paul Moss, and he started by telling me more about him.
He became king in 1964 when his father died. This was a very turbulent period in Greece's politics. And as you said, there was a coup in 1967. Now, this is where he became such a controversial figure. There was a lot of evidence and evidence since that the king, for a while, was happy to cooperate with the so-called colonels who led this coup. He swore them into power. But then he fell out with the colonels and he attempted a counter coup, which failed. And he was banished and sent to live in Rome and then to Britain. So really, he managed to alienate people across the political spectrum. So when democracy was restored in Greece in 1974, they held a referendum. Do you want the king back? And the answer was a resounding no. He was stripped of his citizenship. They took away his palace. And for decades, he wasn't even allowed back into Greece. And he lived in this rather quiet suburb of London, Hampstead Garden Suburb, it's called, in the north of London. And yet, he always called himself King Constantine, even though his title had been stripped. He always insisted that his children were princes and princesses. Anyone who came to visit him was expected to address him as Your Majesty. You get the impression this was someone who never really accepted that the world he'd been part of had gone.
Because of what you've just been saying about him, no surprise and no state funeral for him. Is it an occasion that is rather muted in Athens?
It is. I mean, the Prime Minister was asked why no state funeral, and he said, well, he was the leader of the Kingdom of Greece, and that country doesn't exist anymore. The Prime Minister and President aren't even going, but a huge amount of British and other royalty are turning up. A reminder, really, of that era when kings and queens really did rule Europe. The British monarchy represented by Princess Anne and various other figures. But, you know, before we see this as too tragic, I should say that Greek kings haven't tended to fare very well. There were seven of them in Greece's modern history. Three of them were deposed. One was assassinated. Two were abdicated. And one of them died of septicemia after he was bitten by a monkey. King Constantine died peacefully in a hospital in Athens, his country he was eventually allowed to return to. In some ways, a relatively peaceful ending.
That was Paul Moss. Well, to end the podcast, an appeal from the international conservation group, WWF, for people to help them create a global census of walrus numbers. And the way you do that is to go online, look at specially selected satellite images and record just how many walruses you can see. That will guide researchers into better understanding just how many of them there are and where they are, and, crucially, how climate change is affecting their habitats and lifestyle. Here's our climate and environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
The Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the world, and the sea ice is retreating. But no one is quite sure what that means for the walrus. The huge marine mammals spend much of their time lying on the ice, resting between fishing trips. So conservationists are worried about what will happen to them as the ice melts away. This is the second phase of the WWF's Walrus Detective Project. The first got the public to go through 500,000 satellite images to pinpoint those containing walruses. Now they've been found, the WWF want people to go to their website and count how many of the animals are in each frame. That information will help form a full population census of the Atlantic walrus and enable scientists to better understand how they're coping as their world rapidly changes.
Jonah Fisher. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Now, a message from one of our listeners. Hello, I'm a podcast subscriber in Canada who suddenly has the opportunity to come to London. Here in Canada, I'm an audio technician working with concert audio, corporate meetings, hybrid in-person live streams, and houses of worship. I'm wondering if there's any chance I might be able to see the studio, meet the voices where the Global News podcast is created. Do you ever have an opening for people to meet podcast subscribers? Well, that is from Randy and Janine Brown. And guess what? Randy and Janine are here now. Janine is filming in the corner of the studio. Randy, you are the subscriber. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. Firstly, how long have you been listening to the podcast for?
Oh, it's been some years. And prior to that, I was a professional driver. And so I would listen to BB World Service on AM and FM radio.
Okay, so what do you like about it? What particular elements of it?
Well, the podcast I really enjoy because it's a great snapshot of some of the things that are going on around the world, and it's a broader perspective. You know, when you pick up your phone and look at your feed, it's mostly local stuff. So it's listening to the podcast is a great way to get my head out of my country and into some of the other countries around the world.
Any particular places you'd like to hear more from?
Oh, boy. I mean, it's sad to hear the news from Nepal. We have a couple of friends from there, yeah. And it's good to know what's happening in Nepal. We're glad to hear it mentioned.
Okay. Listen, well, thanks for listening. I'm going to put you on the spot now for a second, because would you mind reading today's message for others to get in touch?
Sure, I can do that.
Okay.
If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod.
You're going to put me out of a job. Listen, thank you so much, Randy. And Janine, filming as she goes. This edition was mixed by Paul Mason. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles. And until next time, goodbye.